Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, three-time Oprah pick and New York Times bestselling author Wally Lamb. Readers may recall She's Come Undone, or This Much Is True. His latest novel is The River Is Waiting. Welcome, Wally.
Hey, Mindy, thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
So I think it was the day The River Is Waiting came out, or it might have been the next day, that Oprah chose yet another one of your books. I want to go back to that first phone call that you got. This was before Oprah even had a book club. It was an Oprah pick, but this was for She's Come Undone. Tell us about that. You get this phone call and like, do you go, wait, is somebody like playing a joke on me? What's going on?
Yeah, I was doing laundry at the time, putting clothes from the washer to the dryer. My wife was putting supper on the table, and I got a phone call. One of my kids answered it, and he's like, yep, no, dad. And so I come to the phone, and the person says, is this Wally? And I said, yes. And she said, what are you doing, Wally? And I said, laundry. And she said, so I'm thinking to myself, whoever this is, I don't think she does her own laundry. I said, who is this anyway? She says, this is Oprah Winfrey. And I said, I didn't say, I thought, yeah, right, you're Oprah and I'm Geraldo Rivera, you know? but anyway, it was just too good an invitation. And she said it was not about her show, which was, you know, hugely popular. There was no, as you said, there was no Oprah book club yet. This was in 1992. She's Come Undone had just come out. And she said, yeah, I read your novel and I really loved it. And my producer, Alice McGee, and I, when we swap books and when we really love a book, we try to track down the author in the phone book and call him just to say thanks. And I'm like, no problem. You know? and then 5 years later, there was a book club, and very fortunately for me and the publisher, she remembered that book and she featured it. Yeah. On her book club, and I think it was either the third or fourth book in this phenomenon that was happening.
Yeah, crazy. The book club. And then, of course, it was what 6 years later when This Much Is True came out, and then she chose that. And are you thinking, all right, how do I top that? Right, two novels. Yeah. Oprah's picked both of them, and you're thinking,
right. Yeah.
And I know I've asked you this before, but then it's like you kind of go, you sort of have that little bit of imposter syndrome, right?
Yes, very much so. And I really struggled. I had a book contract for book number three, and I also had like a ridiculous amount as far as the advance for that because of the Oprah endorsements. And I shut down. I couldn't go forward. I was too intimidated. And as you say, how can I top this? So that was not an easy time for me. It's sort of like the flip side of commercial success the pressure becomes unbearable.
Yeah. I think readers of your books already know this, but you have this really great ability to get into the minds of your characters. You're a really great observer of the human condition. And I'm wondering, they're very complex characters that you have. And I'm wondering, where do these come from? Do these characters just kind of pop into your head? Are they based on real people? Talk a little bit about your character development.
Yeah, they're not based on real people. And one of the things that I really love to do is to, once I've got a character that I'm interested in following, I become the character. I write in first person point of view. If I keep at it, I get to know those people on a deeper and deeper level. Even though when I'm in my work day, I am this other persona other than myself, I'm feeling parental toward them lots of times. I'm worried about them because I don't know how their story is going to come out. And it's not necessarily going to be, happy. It might be, happy with conditions, and it might be tragic. So, yeah. So I hear actors talk about their work and how, before they go on the stage, they slip out of their own skin and put on somebody else's skin. And that's kind of like what it's like for me. Luckily, I can be myself again when I turn the computer off and go upstairs and talk to my wife and have a social life sometimes, and that's it.
And some of your books are based in this town, Three Rivers, but that is based on your hometown that you grew up in, of Norwich, Connecticut, right?
We're on the, I like to say we're on the more humble side of Connecticut, Eastern Connecticut, where we don't eat pate, but we eat liverwursts. And I think it's probably the same thing. Anyway, Three Rivers is a sort of a combination of Norwich and Willimantic, of a factory town where the factories are all closed down. We live there, and also New London, Connecticut. So, kind of a mishmash of all three of those towns.
All right, so your new book, The River's Waiting, your main character, Corby, he's a young father struggling with a terrible tragedy that he creates, right? And it's a story, hope, redemption, and the big question, the possibility of forgiveness.
Yeah, and that's a tough one, not only for his wife, Emily, to grant that forgiveness, but also he's really struggling to forgive himself. And the tragedy is caused by him, partly because he has become addicted to anti-anxiety medication and also alcohol. And his wife does not know this. He's at home. He's been laid off, and so he is in charge of the kids. He's the he's the stay-at-home dad with 2-year-old twins, and his wife is the breadwinner. And he's he feels like a failure. Loves the kids, but sort of feels guilty that he is not a traditional dad and husband.
Yeah, and you can see where the depression sets in for Corbett, right? He's been laid off, and he's really struggling. And of course, once he starts down that path with the alcohol, and it gets worse and worse, right? And he's really struggling with that, because of what happens. He's held accountable and sent to jail.
His blood is tested when this accident happens. And he kills one of those twins, one of those 2-year-olds, and in the hospital, the child is rushed to the hospital and dies on the way. And Corby, he has his blood tested because there's a suspicion that he's been drinking, and it's morning, and his levels are to other they're going to make him guilty of vehicular homicide.
Yeah. And a lot of the book takes place when he is in prison, right? And I you really bring us there. I mean, really, it's that, there's that shock of incarceration, and you give us a window into that world. No privacy, no cell phones, no internet. You got to pay for everything. And I'm wondering, I'm thinking a lot of that reality, probably what came from you used to, for 20 years, you facilitated a writing program for incarcerated women in Connecticut, right? So I imagine some of their experiences had to influence the sections about how what prison is like, right?
Well, yes, I in 20 years of listening to their discussions and also reading their work, you do get a sense of what the structure is like within the prison, who are the people who are in charge, and so all that, I had all that. And now I realize that men's prisons and women's prisons are different from one another, but there are some institutional stuff that is the same in either, the commissary and the chow hall and stuff like that. And so I was able to use that, but I also did a fair amount of research about men's prison, and the most valuable research that I did concerned people who had been in prison and were giving first person testimony. Everything from, what the slang was. Prisoners have their own language in a lot of ways, and what it's like to ferment alcohol in a toilet tank, and stuff like that. So I was able to use both the women's testimonies and the men's.
So Corbett finds himself in prison, and we're there with him. And the first thing is, who do you trust, right? There's a lot of cliques in prison, and you don't know. You don't know these people yet. And who you trust becomes a pretty big deal.
Oh yeah, it could if you make the wrong choices, it could be very dangerous. And there's an exploitation among prisoners. If particularly for the newbies, somebody may befriend you because they know that your commissary fund is being funded by your family and so forth. So they become your best buddy, or in some cases your lover. And then they can get a TV from the commissary, or they can get this or that, bigger ticket items. And so, prison is not a place where you should trust too many people, and you should kind of feel them out before you hand over that trust.
And you've got a lot of we meet a lot of characters who are serving time with Corby. I want to talk about one, which is Manny. And Manny is I mean, just such a character. And Manny has a really positive outlook.
Yeah, he's Corby's second cellmate. The first one was kind of a disaster, and he's very happy when that prisoner, a guy named Pug, is transferred to another prison. And then Manny, who has kind of been self-appointing as Corby's mentor in all prison life. And Corby is appreciative of that, but he also Manny is kind of buggy, and so he's not sure when Manny becomes his cellmate. But he's a kind guy, and he really considers Corby to be a friend. And like I said, he kind of drives Corby crazy with his music and some of his bossiness, but it's a, I kind of I relied on Manny when I was writing the book for some comic relief, because the story is grim,
It is
and
grim, yeah.
you need to take a breath every once in a while. And then Manny really comes into play when he meets toward the end of the novel. He meets Corby's wife, and he wants to tell his wife about certain things about Corby, and so they meet at a mall, and he reveals things that Emily did not know.
Talk about that for a second, because Emily, we first you write in first person, right? So we don't really we only hear Emily's thoughts through what Corby knows. But you had actually thought about adding some of Emily's perspective, writing from Emily, and you changed your mind.
Yeah, or actually, my editor changed my mind. In the first draft, I was kind of teeter-tottering between a chapter in Corby's point of view, and then a chapter in Emily's point of view, and and they would switch back and forth. But my editor, when she was reading those early chapters, she said, "I think it would be better if you just keep it, to one viewpoint." She says, "The person that we're most interested in is Corby. How is he surviving this? And also, how is he surviving the fact that Emily can't forgive him? And he has killed her child. He has lied about and covered up his addiction and so forth. And he longs. He's in great pain because she's withholding, and she's angry too, and rightly so. You know, you might assume, And but so I liked it when she suggested that I scrapped the Emily chapters, and then I introduced Emily through phone calls between him and her.
Yeah.
Phone calls in prison are tricky, right?
Very tricky, right? We're talking with Wally Lamb. His new novel is The River Is Waiting. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Wally Lamb about his new novel, The River Is Waiting. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're really understanding the struggle that Corbett's going through. But also, we really empathize with Emily. We feel her anger, too. So we're emphasizing with both. And I'm wondering, I know that as you're writing and you've got your main characters and then you've got these other characters like Manny and, you know, do you find sometimes that there's a character who you're going, be quiet. This is not your story. And they go, no, no, I'm part of this story. And these characters kind of sometimes take over and get a bigger role in the story than you anticipated.
Yes, that happens just about in every novel of mine. And I love that when that happens, because, you know, I feel like, I'm not, I don't really feel like the master puppeteer who's pulling the strings and ignoring people in the background. I love it when characters demand that they have a voice, and they want to, or and they can maybe, you know, turn the plot in a different direction. I like those surprises. That's what, for me, that's one of the most fun things about writing fiction.
All right, talk about the library. The prison library plays a big role in this story.
And it did in the prison where I volunteered. There was a wonderful librarian there, a guy named Joe Lee, who you know, when he wanted to innovate or do certain things, you know, the standard answer from administration was no, you can't do that. You can't have Buddhist monks come and speak to the women, you know, that kind of thing. But Joe is, what was cool about Joe is that he didn't take no for an answer. He would just, you know, keep nudging and so forth. And he got a lot of programs and things in that way. So I really admired his work with the women, and they felt, I think, you know, they felt safe with him. So the library became a kind of an oasis for them. And I wanted to create a character where that could happen to Corby as well. And so Mrs. Millman is that character.
Also, Corby has a complex relationship with his father.
His father is an academic, and his specialty is science and biology particularly, and he has always sort of communicated to Corby when he was a kid that he wasn't quite measuring up. You know, his father had expected him to go into science and you know, get a higher degree you know, in a university and so forth. But Corby, he was drawn to drawing and art. And when he decided he was going to become an art major in college, his father was not happy with that, and was very vocal about that. He also, the father also left Corby and his mother when Corby was a young teen, and he left because he was having an affair with his one of his grad students. And so his father has always been difficult. His father-son relationship for Corby.
Yeah. I want to go back to the writing program that you did with the incarcerated women. Tell us a little bit how, first, how you got to be doing that. Somebody asked you as a favor, right? And it ended up being this 20-year project, right?
I thought I was going down to the Niantic, Connecticut prison for one time, one 90-minute session. And I had just come from the second Oprah book club thing. I was on the show and so forth. And so I had about 40 women who signed up to hear what I had to say. And then at the end, you know, I said, well, does anybody have questions about writing or my writing or just writing in general. And the questions were like, you know Oprah? And does Oprah have false eyelashes and all that kind of stuff? So anyway, I was packing up my briefcase and getting ready to get out of there after my 90-minute commitment, when one of the women, she had been looking, she had a fierce look on her face, and I could tell she's like, she's probably thinking, what the hell is this guy doing here? What's his bit? And so I was very surprised when she was the one who raised her hand at the end and said, "Thank you for coming." And I said, "Oh, you're welcome." And she said, "Are you coming back?" And she was so scary to me that I wimped out and I said, "Okay, I'll come back in 2 weeks. Why don't you write something, 2 pages? I don't care what it is, and we'll talk about your writing and maybe have a little workshop on critiquing what to do and what not to do when you critique somebody else's work." So when I expected them to do something, we went from 40 women to about, I don't know, 9 or 10. But they were fiercely interested in telling their stories, and it was just so exciting to work with students who were hungry to learn. And so yeah, I just kept going, and every every 2 weeks for 20 years. What was, I would drive to the prison thinking to myself, "Oh, I don't have time for this. I don't know why I keep doing this." And then when I left the prison at the end of class, each time I'd have a smile on my face and just be so happy that I had worked with students who appreciated my being there and who really wanted to learn and get better as writers.
And really, you developed some wonderful relationships with these women over the years.
Well, we didn't plan, I didn't plan to publish an anthology of their work, but they were just so invested in revision, and they got so good at critiquing one another that their work became publishable. My publisher at the time was Judith Regan at HarperCollins, and one day I went into New York and I was talking to her and telling her about this program that I'm so excited about, and she said, "Oh, you'll have to send me something from them." And I had gone in on the train and had been, going through the women's papers. I said, I pulled one out of my briefcase and I read it to her, and she had tears in her eyes by the end, and she said, "This is way better than a lot of the professional writing that I read." And so she said, "Let's do a book." So we ended up doing two books, and we were ready to go with a third that has some of the best writing in it. But that never happened. That third book ran into legal problems and never was published. But yeah, the fact that I was the fact that they were published authors was so good for them, and it's such a great lesson that you work hard at something and look what can happen.
One of the things in the book, there's some advice that Corby gets, and it's really about hope, right? And you're right, this is his character, the character talking. Having hope was never going to hurt me, but having unreasonable expectations could clobber me and start me drinking and drugging again. Knowing the difference between hope and expectations, that was such a wonderful point. Talk about where you got that.
Well, I got that in an AA meeting that I attended. When you mentioned that third novel and how it sort of shut me down and intimidated me, and so I couldn't, because I couldn't move forward with a book contract or that was going to pay me lots of money to write it, I just shut down. And it was uncomfortable, and so I started drinking. In my 50s, I went from being a, I would say, an enthusiastic drinker to a problem drinker. And I drank that way for about 10 years. And part of the reason why I began to over rely on alcohol was that we had adopted a third son. He was our nephew biologically, but he was in great jeopardy with his birth parents, who were addicts. And so he came into our life, and when he was 4 years old, and it was a tough go. He was diagnosed with something called reactive attachment disorder, and which meant, oversimplification. It was like he doesn't have the ability to form loving connections. So anyway, he was, it was hard raising this kid. And so one day I was in my share in AA. I was talking about how hard it was, and I happened to say, I want to remain hopeful about him, that he's going to be okay in the end, but I don't want hope to sucker punch me over and over and over. And so this guy at the end, he was one of the elders of the AA group. He came up to me and he said, "Hope isn't going to ever sucker punch you, but expectations will." And that was like a life raft thrown to me, because I began to see the difference, and it helped me. It has helped me to stay sober, not to think that you're gonna fix somebody else, that that person has to fix himself.
I read somewhere that they said that likened talking to you is like talking to a therapist. And I think anybody who reads your books and sees the empathy, I mean, you're like I said, you have this empathetic, like, just nature about you. And I asked you that when we did an event a few weeks ago, and I asked you, where does that come from? Have you always had that empathy? And you really have.
Yeah, I think, but it really sort of developed and helped me evolve about when I started teaching in high school, and I began to see that not all of the kids that I worked with had ideal home situations, and the more they wrote, the more they wrote about some of the difficulties in their home life, and that kind of opened my eyes. And I didn't feel sympathy, because that's something where you place yourself above the other person. Oh, I feel sorry for you. But it just came naturally, my empathy for them, because I was able to imagine if that had been me, who had been sexually abused by a relative, or popped in the mouth because I said something that somebody else at home didn't appreciate, that kind of thing. So that's where, and that's so I brought that ability to empathize into my work, my fiction work, and because I'm writing first person, and becoming that person, yeah, that's good for empathy.
Let's go back to She's Come Undone. Talk about your relationship with your character, Dolores Price. So many people really related to that book. And Dolores, I think I heard you say when you started this, you really you it was a voice, right? But you didn't have a visual of her yet.
No. And I had about maybe 75 pages or so, and this is my first attempt to write fiction of any kind. So I was going to start by writing this short story about that character, and it just kept rising like bread dough or something. It got bigger and bigger, and so a teacher of mine at the time, a writing teacher, said, "Well," she said, "this is too long to be a short story." And I said, "Well, what should I do? What should I cut?" And she said, "Well, maybe you don't cut anything. Maybe you're trying to write a novel." And I think if I knew that then that it would have been a 9-year journey with writing alongside Dolores, I might have run out of the room screaming or something. But I stayed with it because I cared about that character. And even though I was writing as if I was she, I was feeling parental toward her. And she was one of those characters who was not particularly controllable And I would see something happening, like a little movie in my head of what was going to happen next. And I'm like, oh no, I can't, I can't let her do that. I can't let her go up the stairs and flirt with this, with this tenant of her grandmother's, and that's going to come to no good. I had to keep writing that because that was the truth as I knew it, in Dolores's story.
And a lot of times I know you've been asked how you're able to accomplish writing from a woman's perspective. Here you are d becoming Dolores and writing and getting it right.
Well, thank you, Mindy. But you're if you pick up She's Come Undone, you're reading draft, I don't know, 73 or something. And I work in a writer's group, and they were never shy about, particularly the women in the group, were never shy about when I hit false notes. So I had about 9 years to, sand down the rough edges. And I also grew up with sisters and girl cousins next door. And so I was kind of, I kind of knew the lay of the land. The only other kid, the only other boy on McKinley Avenue that I could play with was a kid named Vito. And Vito used to throw rocks at me. So, he wasn't exactly playmate material.
So
So
I'll play
I
with
would
the
always be,
girls.
yeah, or observe the girls.
I was, and there are some who say, what happened to Dolores? Where is she now? Right, even though she's a fictional character, and some may not have caught it, but you did make a brief mention of her in one of your other books, right?
Yeah, in The Hour I First Believed, she marries a guy who's a baker, who's in that novel. He is the main character's good friend, but she's kind of a stealth character in that, because he doesn't call her Dolores, he calls her Dee. And this is her second marriage. Her first marriage ended with the death of her husband, and so that's just my way of waving to the to the people who had read and enjoyed She's Come Undone. It was like, yeah, she's still out
She's
there.
still there.
Yeah.
Talk about where you have this voice of Dolores, and then you put together her physical characteristics. Talk about how you discovered that.
Yeah. Many years before, I had been a student teacher at a high school, and I was working with a senior class. One of the members of that class was a young woman who was obese, and she used to sit at the back of the room at a table because she couldn't fit in the regular desk set. And she never said anything. She didn't, she had her defenses up. And here I am, this dopey student teacher. I come in and I'm going to save her life. I'm going to pull her into the conversation, and she's going to feel like one of the class rather than, an outlier. And so I attempted that several times, and she wanted none of it. She would not answer the questions, and she would sit there in a very defensive pose with her arms crossed across her chest, and so it was a failure. But I always thought of her. I wonder what she's doing now. I wonder, high school seemed like it was torture for her. So I wonder what happened to her after that. And then as I say, I had Dolores's voice, and all of a sudden, when the voice met the image of this young woman sitting in the back of a classroom, that's when the novel really took off. I mean, I was writing with loose leaf pages and Bic pens, and I couldn't keep up fast enough once I had the voice and the image combination.
Right. We're talking with Wally Lamb. His latest novel is The River Is Waiting. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with author Wally Lamb. His latest novel is The River Is Waiting, his third Oprah Book Club pick. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, a little bit of trivia here that I think maybe people don't know is the titles of your books come from songs.
Yeah, music has always been really important in my life, and I've been a big record collector, and then CDs, and now streaming. And lots of times, I play music while I'm writing, and sometimes, lots of times, a lyric will, a snatch of lyric or a song title will sort of hit me at like a little imp or something, and I realize it's sort of giggling and saying, when I'm trying to figure out the meaning of a story, here you go. And that happened with "The River Is Waiting." I heard that song being performed. It was written by John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater Revival. But I heard a version sung by Irma Thomas, the diva of New Orleans music, and it was beautiful. And then I started thinking, okay, the river is waiting. There was a river in the novel I was writing, but the river is waiting, and that's the title of that song. And I'm thinking, okay, so what is the river waiting for? Who is the river waiting for? And it became like a riddle that I had to solve, and I couldn't solve the riddle until I had reached the end of the story.
Yeah, I think I told you when I was reading the book, I went, okay, the title's "The River's Waiting," and we don't get to the river for quite a while, but once we do, it all makes sense, right? And of course, she's come undone, along with the zombies, right? This much is true.
The guess who.
A guess who? Sorry, and yeah, and you got a thing for twins. Twin, I know the "this much is true" is identical twins, where one brother gets schizophrenia. You've got twins in this book. What is the fascination with twins?
I think it is a fascination, and probably envy too, because like I say, there was only Vito to play with in our neighborhood, and I would always think about, if I were a twin, then I would have a built-in soulmate, and that has sort of carried. I'm really fascinated with the different kinds of relationships between particularly identical twins. Sometimes they're each other's friends, best friends. Sometimes they feel like half of something. And then there are identical twins who go to war against each other too. So, there's all kinds of variations on that twins relationship.
Yeah. Talk about your writing process. I mean, you mentioned you go down into your office, which I'm assuming is in the basement since you're saying down, right? So,
Yeah.
do you go in first thing in the morning? Do you write every day? What's your process?
Monday through Friday, I go to the gym first. I'm an early riser, and so I get, I get my blood flowing, and then I just, come home, have a breakfast, and then go down there. Sometimes I dread going down because, writing can be a lonely life. And my wife is around upstairs, and so I see her when I take breaks and so forth. But I usually go from maybe 8:30 in the morning until about 2:30, and then for some reason my creative brain shuts off, and then I can deal with the business end of the writing career. But yeah, it just sort of it stops, and I know when it stops that I'm not going to do anything more. However, between those hours of 8:30 and 2 o'clock, say, something might not be, it might not be a good writing day, but I stay parked in that chair because, I have to wait it out. And then lots of times toward the end of that daily schedule, something will hit me, and I'll keep going. So it's about, it's about creativity, but it's also about perseverance, not giving up.
Also, too, I could see where sometimes you dread going downstairs, like, well, look at what Corbett's going through, and now you got to go down and go through that with him, right?
Be him again,
Yeah,
yeah.
be him again. But I do know that sometimes when you're having a really rough time, you do come upstairs and watch a little Days of Our Lives.
Oh, you outed me. Yes, that's true. It's a good escapism. And then I like the it's the writing can be very far-fetched,
Yeah.
And I like being, sitting there being the critic, and I'll sit there watching it with my wife, and we'll look at each other and we're going, why, how, it's so embarrassing. Why, that we're fans of this. But it's good escapism.
It's
My
fun.
assistant Allison, gave us coffee cups for Christmas, and they both say, if loving Days of Our Lives is wrong, I don't want to be right.
That's so funny. So you write in a very conversational style, right? Your books explore complex characters, difficult issues, often tragedy, but occasionally you do something different. And I'm thinking of Wishing and Hoping, which was a bit of a departure for you, right? This was a short, comically nostalgic novel about parochial school, and it's a fifth grader, and it's in 1964. I can't help but think maybe you're reaching back in some of your own memories for that. And Wishing and Hoping, that one was made into a movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a Lifetime Christmas movie, starring Molly Ringwald and a bunch of fifth grade kids, and the late great Meatloaf, who played a drunken Monsignor at the parochial school. I myself did not go to parochial school. People are surprised if they've read that, but I've always loved talking to kids who were in parochial school, and some of the crazy stories that they come up with about the nuns, or the dynamic of that. And that's where that came from. And that I had such great fun when I was writing that. And Felix Funicello, who is a distant cousin of the iconic Annette Funicello, he was a lot like I was, or he is a lot like I was when I was a kid.
Yeah. And I think probably too, this might have harkened back to you growing up where you used to make your own comic books. That's where you really started your writing, right? You started young, but it was not in the style you do now. It was comic books and you did a lot of drawing.
Yeah, it was more about the image than the writing. I love to draw. There was people of a certain age may remember a TV artist named John Negi, Nagy, I think it was, and he would come on every day, and he would teach you how to draw. You would be working on a seascape or something, and he would, okay, now do this line. Okay, now make this shadow right here, and then he would break for commercial. When he came back, his drawing would be finished, and you were sitting there with not knowing what to do next. But yeah, he was kind of like, who's that? Bob? Was it Bob Ross, the guy with
Yes.
the? Yeah, he was sort of he was sort of an early version of Bob Ross.
Yeah. Going back to The River Is Waiting, one of the big questions in the book, and we're not going to give the answer, but is really about forgiveness. And I think when you walk away from that novel, it really gives you so much to think about. And I think forgiveness is one of the big themes there. What are you hoping people walk away with after reading that novel?
Well, Mindy, when I'm writing a book, it's mine. And then when it's if you're lucky enough to get it published and it's sent out into the world, it's not mine anymore. So I leave forgiveness of Corby as a kind of an open-ended thing that people, readers might get on board with or not. I was in Saratoga Springs on book tour last night, and one of the listeners to the event that we were doing had a during the Q&A, she said, do you think Corby is redeemed in this novel? And I said, well, what do you think? And she said, I don't think he is, and other people do think he is. And I think that is the right of every reader to make their own decision. And I try not to stack the deck in any way.
Yeah, I would say though there's a couple of guards in that story that I would not have some forgiveness for. They're bad.
Yeah. And the reason why they're bad is that they are powerful, because correctional officers who can get away with a lot of stuff because, who you're going to believe if
Right.
you're, if there's a grievance filed, who are you going to believe? One of these, one of these no good, felons or correctional officers.
Right.
So they really take advantage of that. And, I think, Mindy, that one of the things that comes up over and over in my novels is the theme of powerful misuse of power against powerless people.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So, what kind of advice do you have for up-and-coming writers?
That's another question that came up last night, and it usually does. I would say if you have a fantasy of bestsellerdom, chase that away because it's about the writing, not the result. And go at it as often as you can. Be patient with the process, and write it for yourself, not for any particular audience. When I started writing She's Come Undone, I thought it was going to be a YA novel, and my teacher at the time said, no, don't decide who your audience is going to be. Explore your own truth and have faith that the audience who's meant to find it will find it.
Right.
So that's been good advice for me.
And do you, I know you have been in a writer's group. Writer's groups can be also very helpful, right? For beginning
Oh
writers.
yeah, for me, yeah. I've been with the same people for decades now. Some are poets, some are creative nonfiction writers, and some of us are fiction writers. And when you prescribe for other people's early drafts, you learn, you can learn things about your own work. And when you get the gift of feedback, I just sit there, I shut up during when people are reacting to the work that I present, and I just write like crazy. And lots of times I don't necessarily agree with what's being said, but 2 days later, when I reread my notes, it's like, aha, they were
Yeah.
right.
And rejection. I mean, that's part of the business, right? And you could get rejected, and then all of a sudden, you just have to, like you say, keep trying.
I'll tell you a quick story about a short story that I submitted to a literary magazine, and it came back, and sorry, this is not going to be right for us, but we'll try us again. A polite little note, and then because I am such a bad businessman, I forgot that I had sent that story to them, and I sent it again. I was mortified, and that I had done that. But then I got a call from that magazine saying, "Yeah, we love this story. We're gonna feature it." And it won the award for the best short story of the year. And it got me my agent because she had read that
Listen,
story and pursued a
you
relationship
never
with me.
know.
So,
Yeah.
you just never know. It's a crapshoot. It
Yeah.
can be,
Yeah.
yeah.
All right, so well, you're going to be at the Vineyard Book Festival, which is running August 1st through the 3rd. So, and the latest novel is The River Is Waiting. Wally Lamb's always such a joy to talk to you. Thanks so much for being here.
I'll send that right back to you, Mindy. It's always great fun and worthwhile to spend an hour with you.
Right. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.